Welcome to Articulate Warbling, hosted by Zach Ferguson, edited and produced at Badger's Drift Studio. If you enjoyed this podcast, please contact us at pgttcm.com and let us know. We would love to make more of this show for you. And here he is, Zach Ferguson with... Articulate Warbling.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to episode 6 of It's Not a Rant, It's Articulate Warbling, with me, your host, your reviewer, your warbler, Zach Ferguson. Now, today I shall be reviewing Terminator. Dump fart. It's me, it's Arnie, I'm back! So is Jim Cameron! So is Jim Cameron! Though he only gets a producer credit! Dum 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 da dum! I'm back! Dum 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 da dum! So is Linda Hamilton! Da dum dum da dum! Cough! It's really not worth it! Cough! Bloody hell! It's really not worth it! That gag, to the detriment of my breathing and lungs and capacity to inhale, exhale. Dum 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 da dum. I knew it. It's gonna be a big hit. Dum 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 da dum. Linda Hamilton. Da dum dum da dum. James Cameron. Da dum dum da dum. Me, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Dum 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 da dum. It makes no fucking difference, as it doesn't. I'm going to be reviewing Terminator Damp Fart. No, Terminator Dark Fate. Now, I want to start this review off by being very honest and very transparent with you. I absolutely adore all sequels that have come before. And one especially being Terminator Salvation. I love that they did way with that retrograde, post-80s, early 90s science fiction sheen and aesthetic and design, something that pretty much was Jimmy Cameron's vision. It was gritty, it was a war film, post-apocalyptic, Cormac McCarthy sensibilities and aura and stylings. I loved that real dirty look and feel. The post-apocalyptic nuances that you'd find from these types of stories. It was really unlike anything else, and a lot of people criticised it due to the name associated, Mac G, who's known for his Charlie's Angels films, known for his hyper-stylized action sequences, but the lack of depth. I really like Terminator Salvation. I really like Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines, all apart from the terrible on-screen non-apparent chemistry between the young fella who played John Connor and Claire Danes. But I'm not going to get too hung up on that, because in all honesty, I've found that all the sequels have been great, and I will be, again, very transparent. I don't like Terminator 1. I really don't. It's aged terribly, though it implemented a great idea. Jimmy Cameron hit the reset button with Terminator Judgment Day. He pretty much did that and made one of the most glorious action science fiction films ever created. One of the best performances by Arnold Schwarzenegger. But then, again, was it? Because here's something where this might be the clincher to whether you take me seriously or not. The last Terminator film, because this is the 6th in the franchise, a franchise that is notorious for hitting that reset button. It plays out the same fucking tropes and the same machinations of having a reason to have this film re-released. The time travel aspects and tropes and avenues gives us, you know, a bit of weight and heft and meaning behind, and almost an excuse to keep resetting the button. But I loved the previous film, Terminator Genesis, because it was Arnold Schwarzenegger returning to a role that he obviously loves, and it had nuance, it had emotion. He was coming from a place where he'd not played this character since 2003, and it was much missed. And I thought the retrograde aesthetic of the post-80s, early 90s, captured by Alan Taylor and all visual effects teams and design teams and art directors perfectly, but in a modernized aesthetic. I thought it was great. I thought it had nuance. So there's a quibbles and all that. I really loved the science. I watched Terminator Genesis, and it really reminded me of something that stylistically that you would envision the science fiction space opera novelist Neil Asher would create, the almost hyper technicalities of
the visuals and the descriptions, and also when it comes to nanobot technology and all such and sundry, the textural compositions. And I just thought it was very nuanced and very entertaining. Like, that reset button, it was invalidated in who they cast as Sarah Connor, and especially, you know, Kyle Reese. But the thing is, don't be beholden to that. Emilia Clarke and her co-star, the Aussie. I don't know how I've forgotten his name, but I've forgotten him. The man who played Captain Boomerang. They were good together. I really liked that film. I really enjoyed it. It paid homage, nods, you know, Easter eggs for all fans of Terminator. And I just thought it was visually, aesthetically pleasing. So when I saw the trailer to Terminator Dark Fate, it was like, it's got more in common with that than Terminator Judgment Day. And I've got to be frank and honest, Terminator Dark Fart, Dark Fate, is not good. The sum of all of its parts is very simple. Let's hit reset. Linda Hamilton, Arnold Schwarzenegger, we are doing the official, everything that's just fucking rub out everything that's come before. This is the real direct follow-up we deserve. Jimmy Cameron is back. It's all about bidding wars. It's all about cash flow. This has no reason or intent. People are breezily going through this. The whole ideology and reasoning behind this is we can make money off of it because Linda Hamilton, Schwarzenegger and Cameron want to make as much as they can off the back of this. They want to make a welcome return. I'm not taking away from Linda Hamilton. She is badass in this. But it's that reset thing. They're doing the same old thing, but repeat, but doing it no better than they tried last time with the third. And what they did far better with Terminator Genesis. It just is hollow. It is lacking something, a vital ingredient. The sum of all its parts, of which it's personifying, nostalgia, the taste for Linda Hamilton's return, Schwarzenegger. Schwarzenegger looks fucking bored throughout this film, reining it in, whereas there was real sentimentality and emotion and connectivity with his return and performance in Terminator Genesis. Also, the story here, I'm not even going to waste my breath or my time trying to explain it, because it's just the same old rehash bollocks. Also, this is directed by Tim Miller, who made a huge, like, you know, directorial debut with Deadpool. He really introduced something, his own flavourings, his own aesthetic. Here, he tries to bring nods, antidotes, things that refer to the previous beloved first two films, but it doesn't work. It just is in a vain hope to capture some people's nostalgic connectivity to it. It's just lazy. It's also features some of the worst visual effects ever put onto screen, especially with our modern era of technology and the certain caliber we anticipate. Just takes you out of it. Diego Luna is great in it. He's the only one who's got character. But this film is lacking of story. And it's no surprise because it's by David S. Goyer. And before people start ranting and raving, David S. Goyer brought us the Dark Knight trilogy. No, that was Nolan Brothers. David S. Goyer was only associated with that film by his little additions to the storyline. He's a guy with a lot of money, a lot of credibility, though his work doesn't lend weight or accountability for that. And, you know, but actually it's accountability for being such a terrible scriptwriter and creator. He's a fanboy, but not a fanboy able to evolve from fanboyishisms, and it's just classic David S. Goyer type material screenplay. And this has so many names associated, so having James Cameron's name in the storyline of this means nothing. Because if people harken back to 2015, Cameron, though not associated or involved creatively or producerially with Terminator Genesis, he was out there doing puff pieces and PR where he was associated with it and proclaiming that Terminator Genesis was the real sequel and the real follow-up, the real, you know, hey, I'm James Cameron. I love Avatar, but I've been paid millions just to say, guess what? Terminator Genesis, it really captures something. Something of my original films that the sequels didn't. He was doing fucking puff pieces for that film. Now that's just been written out of history. Fucking time travel doesn't exist. It, you know, wiping the slate clean in such a way from the whole general worldwide, nationwide, fucking universe's consciousness does not work like that. This film is a vain hope to kickstart a new series with new young blood, with Mackenzie Davis and this person, that person. It doesn't work because it is just done in a vainglorious way, but done very weakly, done very sloppily. It has no reason or purpose to be here except a cash flow, trying to reignite a franchise, trying to allow other studios to keep right. It's a hodgepodge of so many other, you know, most commercial, capitalist, idealistic fucking ideologies and machinations that it just shows it for what it is. Lacking, boring, dire, disinteresting. There's no story, there's no depth, there's no emotion. It is just crap. So that's why Terminator Dark Fate gets 1 star out of 5.
Hey everyone, welcome back. This is me, D.B. Spitzer, the editor and producer of Articulate Warbling with Zach Ferguson. Just wanted to let you know that we're hoping to make this a full-time series and not just a backdoor pilot. So if you would like to help sponsor the show, or if you have anything that you'd be like wanting to donate to help the show keep going, let us know. PGTTCM.com. And where you can reach Zach is in the show notes, and also where you can buy his many books, Zach Ferguson. And you can check him out, of course, on Amazon.com, where he's got all kinds of wonderful books, from Dimension Horse to What Mr. Wants, Mr. Gets.
So Terminator Dark Fate got 1 star out of 5. It was honestly, perhaps one of the worst films I've seen this year. But next up, I shall be reviewing Dead Men's Trousers by Irvin Welsh. And it is perhaps the final book in his Trainspotting series. But first of all, I'm going to read the synopsis. Mark Renton is finally a success. An international jet setter, he now makes significant money managing DJs, but the constant travel, airport lounges, soulless hotel rooms and broken relationships have left him dissatisfied with his life. He's then rocked by a chance encounter with Frank Begbie, from whom he'd been hiding for years after a terrible betrayal and the resulting debt. But the psychotic Begbie appears to have reinvented himself as a celebrated artist and, much to Mark's astonishment, doesn't seem interested in revenge. Sick Boy and Spud, who have agendas of their own, are intrigued to learn that their old friends are back in town. But when they enter the bleak world of organ harvesting, things start to go so badly wrong. Lurching from crisis to crisis, the four men circle each other, driven by their personal histories and addictions. Confused, angry, so desperate that even Hibs winning the Scottish Cup doesn't really help. One of those four will not survive to the end of this book. Which one of them is wearing Dead Men's Trousers? Fast and furious, scabrously funny and weirdly moving, this is a spectacular return of the crew from Trainspotting. Now, Trainspotting is a cultural phenomenon, maybe more notoriously worldwide for the film by Danny Boyle. But since the film, a lot of fanfare and a great fan base has built up specifically for Irvin Welsh. He is one of the most powerful, enigmatic, inventive, pseudo-experimental novelists out there, a Scottish writer himself who suffered his own addictions. He's written so many books that are personal favourites of mine. Filth in particular, The Sex Lives of Siamese Twins, which was a recent release, I think it was about 4 years ago. But his recent traverses within the world of Trainspotting have been a little bit lacklustre. The previous book before Dead Men's Trousers was The Blade Artist, and it was antithetical almost to what the Trainspotting style, specifically the prose and the pace, was within Irvin Welsh's universe. It just seemed a bit mainstream, it seemed a bit, it was conventional, to be honest, and his books have seemed this way in light of recent years. But I think that was a specific thing for him to do within the broadening of the character, the psychotic Begbie, who becomes a almost commercial success himself. So a commercial, almost conventional storyline is allowed. But Dead Men's Trousers, it imbues an inflection of what comes with Trainspotting, its masterful follow-up porno, the prequel Skag Boys, a real sense of rebellion. It's quite poignant and it's quite voracious. It's abrupt, it's brusque, it's rough, it's emotional, it's hilarious. Irvin Welsh knows character, but he also knows his world. Personal experiences, having lived in certain sectors and spots of Scotland. He captures the universe perfectly. And the universe is so perfectly and accurately portrayed, sometimes it comes across as fantastical. But what I really loved was, this feels like a affirmed follow-up to those books. Specifically Trainspotting, specifically Porno. Skagboys and The Blade Artist, a little less so, because as I said, they Skagboys is almost an epic, a prelude to what is inevitably going to happen. A prequel I didn't feel was really justified, but it had that inherent Scottishisms. It was vignette-like. It had no storyline, whereas Skagboys was almost pretty much non-linear, and it had that non-linearity and just episodic nature that Trainspotting did. Porno was more of a story, but it still had the vignettes and character beats that made it and personified it as an urban Welsh Trainspotting. But where Skagboys had that, but on an epic scale, but with more traditional means of composition of characters, placement. Whereas I feel The Blade Artist completely lost that, but I think it was a deliberate intention of Irvine Welsh's, though he's got a lot of criticism for its fast rapidity pace, more within the prose than the characters' dialects and the phonetics of the prose and the exposures of character through dialogue and exposition and setup. It's a fast-paced one, but I think it was almost a meta commentary on the overall sustenance of the book, and specifically pertaining. And I think the book, in its style and its execution and format, perfectly encapsulates what is happening to Begbie in a metatextual way that really drills out into that book. But Dead Men's Trousers has more in common with Trainspotting and Porno than any other. It's just so good to see our characters back. The almost pathetic, desperate, you know, the biggest arsehole of the king of arseholes, Sick Boy. He's selfish. There's no loyalty there. And then when there is loyalty, it's always agenda-based. Mark Renton, a tadpole in a big pond who just wants to find his way. He wants to do right by others, but due to his addiction, and addictions comes in many forms, as such and sundry is ultimately revealed through these book series. And then we have the sympathetic and, you know, Spud, who really personifies addiction in a way that a lot of I, having been exposed and around drug addicts growing up myself and users, they fall upon the crux of, it's an addiction, it's not me, it's the addict. But Spud really encapsulates that innocence, that a life is torn asunder by an addiction. It's not just an excuse for his behaviours. He's a very calm, collected, we're not on the drugs and we're not harried. He's a very, though simplistic, loving character, and I love to see the evolution of these characters, especially specifically them growing up. And weirdly enough, Dead Men's Trousers has a lot in common with the recent T2 Trainspotting 2 sequel, the maturation of character and placement, but still with that kooky inventiveness and rebellious streak that you found within the Trainspotting book and films. Whereas there's a maturation definitely for Danny Boyle's film, and definitely for this book. It is heartwarming in the most, you know, scabrously strange way. It's great to see these characters work around each other, the different dynamics. This is the first time an official sequel within the book verse that we've actually seen them together. The actual fallout, the actual repercussions, the actual, you know, the overall finality to their relationship and what came before, the betrayal, the lies. I just love these characters, and I would love for another book to come out. Though this is a very interesting read, though it has that rapid fire flow and rush, it still has that commercial conventionality in Dead Men's Trousers specifically that shares with The Blade Artist. But I think it's a great juxtaposition, and I think it's very metatextual and very much conceptually and contextually definitive and affirmed and deliberate. Dead Men's Trousers is like all great Irvine Welsh books. Great characters, great payoffs, great setups, great gags. But overall, it has a heart. It has a softness. It has a transparent reality that, you know, one could accuse it of being fantastical, but it being so fantastical, it can, you know, and so absurd, you can only surmise overall that this must come from a place of reality and experience. And I think Dead Men Trousers is a great, if there is a final farewell and a final tip to the Trainspotting universe, I wouldn't complain, because I really do love Irvin Welsh when he works within new universes or within singular pieces, like one-off books, like The Sex Lives of Siamese Twins and Filth, though that had its own semi-spin-off. I still view that as its own peak, and the Bedroom Secrets of Chefs, and it just, I love his isolated pieces because they're transgressive, they're hard, whereas I feel he tries to find a continuity and a streamline of certain narrative devices and tropes and conventionalities up against the more experimental, quasi transgressive and, you know, more rambunctious, extreme places of prose and writing and, you know, surveillance that he comes with his Trainspotting books. But it is an astoundingly gripping read. And if it is the final book, what a great book to go out on. And if it isn't, I'm looking forward to being reintroduced to a few of these characters. I'm not going to give away who actually dies. But Dead Men's Trousers by Irvin Welsh is not a masterpiece, but it is a great read. So that is me done with the reviews for episode 6, but I want to take a little bit of time now to perhaps, if you will allow me, and if you don't mind, to talk about one of my releases. There's been a lot of talk and a lot of advertisement for my serial killer horror psychological experimental novel of What Mr. Wants, Mr. Gets, and my most recent release, my science fiction steampunk experimental William S. Burroughs homage Dimension Whores. But there's not been much talk about Volatile Voices, Volatile Universe, which collects a novel I wrote previously published under the title A Taste of Feeling, but now with the addition of its follow-up, Volatile Voices, Volatile Universe, a novella to tie it all in, I felt that I wanted to release it as one big volume, one big book, and it's a completely different version. So if anyone who has read A Taste of Feeling, don't view this as you're buying the same book. It's completely been re-edited, bolstered, expanded upon, almost rewritten to a point that it is a whole different story, and that Volatile Voices, Volatile Universe, the novella follow-up to A Taste of Feeling, is actually, now together, it feels like it's a whole piece, a whole novel. And it is a big book, a big, big book. It's at least 506 to 700 to 800 pages. Let me look here. Actually, 507 pages. And I just wanted to really take the time to read the synopsis and maybe just talk a little bit about the story. But here's a synopsis for Volatile Voices, Volatile Universe by me. We live in a reality that is supposed to be our own. It isn't. Voices break through in textual compositions. A reality crafted by our own hand, our own, their own. A sum of many, many parts of this slop of material. We are existing on multiple planes of existence, layered, tiered, dormant, existing, birthing, dying, fizzling out. Our decisions are not our own. It is dictated by a melange of our other selves, our parallel selves, our truer selves. And if that isn't comfortable enough for you to accept, to compute, to define as a narrative streak, there's a billion others in the wings to be hung up for contemplation. Those voices, those rippling, bending, curvature, noise, made material, ectoplasmic events, altered. Not one singular vision of yourself, but all of yourselves. These phantom images, these intrusive thoughts, these deja vu moments are our own extremely tempered voices. Ever so volatile. Breaching, reaching out. Part of an even greater webwork and mapping. Making its own sub-pocket in space and time. Where? Out there? In there? Indicate to your own head, thus meaning your mind, personified within itself as a multi-layered universe, itself ever so volatile. Meet a whole host of characters whose singular, epic, contained stories all interweave to culminate into a broader, far more pretentious cosmic whole. Meet that man who exists on the fringes of a young girl's reality, a girl who in question is the focal point to all of these characters, whose realities are splayed out, who is a key component to this fractured, abusive, controversial, volatile universe and novel. Now, I have a personal love for Volatile Voices, Volatile Universe. I think it's one of my favourites. It came from a place of total mental disintegration, mental projection, a real, almost mental breakdown of an artist. I feel like I can't create unless I'm angry, unless I have something to say societally or about my own personal interludes and facades and charades and facades and facades and all the facades are hard, hard. It was at a place of real deep, dark depression, and I feel that the best forms of art and creativity comes from a place of anger, temper, and especially when it's suppressed, because when you unleash it, it's like withholding an orgasm. It's a great big explosion, but onto the page. And Volatile Voices, Volatile Universe is something that I am extremely proud of and I absolutely adore. So I'm going to read just a teeny tiny extract of the novel. Chapter 5, The Knotworm, and the narrative and time streams of multiple realities clash. God! Oh God! The cries continued to slowly trace their way through Terry's misty, vaguely conscious self, breaching the folds and dense interiors of the imagined place known as the subconscious. Consciousness had been opened, flayed. Now everything was smudged, rubbed in like a spillage of ink into somebody's crowning piece of art. And in your haste to try and save it, you ruin it. Fuss, make it better. You give it its reason to be a crowned achievement. Everything was as one, congealed, meshed, intricated. The screen sounded muffled as they continued to stretch off deeper and deeper into that recess of his mind. Flagrant stirrings and loins without serpentine tongue lashings of salvation hall meisters that he dares not lurk or spend too much time in. But as in nightmares, it is not optional. Get! A death rattle that didn't quench their thirst. It broke off. It was stale. Could be even described that it staled itself. If honesty, if allowed to transcend through the folds of time and be translated through this written narration, the more heft and resonance and actual deep gut plea associated with that word, not a title, it's just a word, and the more these said demons, once as human beings, would ignore Terry's pleas. Yes, it may stall them for a while, but only to hope that Terry will come to realise screaming with such potency and belief in the word God is merely beyond futile. It's pathetic. They are and were the gods. They are, we are the gods. They are and were the gods. Because they had control of this situation, like Terry would be a god, lowercase g, if he were not trapped. What also makes them more godlike is they have him trapped in his own mind. So if anything to cry to and for, a reasoning behind your yodels and rib rattles, roar, ravage, plea, beg, it should be to these nameless celestials. If there be one, they are tearing into my flesh, burrowing, eating, feasting, taking away more than muscle and bone. Mother, where are you? He was that much afeard, these noiseless, sexless notions mused upon. Why so much rambling and description? Then all becomes clearer. It's his mind. Though he may be trapped in the hollow they have put him in, it's still his to control, his rules, his structure, his mind, his id. They hoped that realisation didn't come forth in his projections, they would lose him. Where did that come from? Was his internally internal, ever so deeply intermusing, that it was an inception of thought, layers masked over by his... What was it? Was it a characterisation of oneself? Or your whole embodiment thinking that was within a thought already? It was his true self, the real true reactions of a damaged man, near breaking point, within his void of free thinking, for a change. So much clarity was afforded, an endless stream of space to fill it up with wonderments and hefty criminal contemplations. The desperation was heightened in his mind, but the screaming, that intrusive voice that could only be of himself in the next 50 years, if he were to survive, crawling out, sniffing the air, reeling in repulsion of the waspish wilt of a man he was, stroke, was becoming. Somebody else filling your head up with dreams, boy. The agonising strain was still wistfully, almost lightly, touching the sides of the cavernous space that was his mind. No more! God fucking help me! Gagging gasps that rebounded but leeringly bounced back. Further, much like a perpetrator scouting out its victim in the dark, footsteps heard, presence known, the initial attack unjust. The voice was of his and his own. And his alone, but it held within it a longing that was either through hardship, that or agony and bad living, that resembled a chain smoker. As if from a very long tunnel, curving off into the nether, the muffling sounds were mingled with a scratching. Not like claws to a front doorstep or porch or of something wanting to break entry, something insidious, as if of something itching to get out, a chorus in unison of many minuscule things, rearing up and pushing at the foundation that holds them victim and imprisoned. The sound was disorientating. It silenced that other... an enclosed space, spherically entrapping Terry in open, endless, exceptionally distant voids within voids within voids within splices within subdimensionally. Subdimensionality driven analyzed uselessness personified celestial petri dishes crafted from molecular strands of mucus substance. When hitting an earth and air current, he could sense that freedom, so close yet so far and so unreasonably mocking. The continuation of a barrier of mixed sounds and the wailing, which were of him, whether of memory or that of some malformed future, that were perhaps of just the miasma of nightmares, were not silenced, not so soon. It was by a barricade of stone, justly carried off, lingering for an age, not withheld, like one of a nervous disposition, muffling through cloth or softened tissue. Murderer's hands, oddly attentive, whilst the life ran out of you, and the poison was inhaled and percolated inside you. In and out. The sound was travelled by a long distance, from afar, from an alternate reality. Now finally, at its close, hesitant to breach the entry point of Terry's mind, it reached out an invisible tentacle, connected by assumption, that power of beyond the universe and dimensions to ensnare him, to entangle him, to comfort him, to grow loose, to build internal prospects of self, of courage, of strength, of fate, only to silence him finally with a snap of the neck. Now, I hope you enjoyed that little sneak peek, and I hope you join me for the next episode, episode 7, and Volatile Voices, Volatile Universe is available to buy on Amazon. Best wishes. Thank you very much, and I hope you have a great day.
Written by Zach Ferguson, produced and edited by D.B. Spitzer, recorded at Badger Strip Studios in glorious Portland, Oregon. Zach's part is, of course, recorded in Brighton, England. Want to help the show? Go to pgttcm.com. Check out what we've got. Go to Zach's shop in the show notes. Go to Zach's Instagram in the show notes. Find out how to help him out. And of course, Ashton Manor, Darkest Child by Kevin MacLeod.